two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
It is Hard Knock Radio, David D, hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we have a special gathering. We have longtime friend and journalist and somebody who is frequently on our airwaves, the one and only Rosa Clemente. You know her for her activism. She was the former vice presidential candidate in 2008 along with Cynthia McKinney for the Green Party. And she had alerted me that she was going to be building and doing a live broadcast with our next guest, Dr. Cornel West, who we all know and love for his work, his activism. He's a scholar, he's a writer, he's a freedom fighter. And he is somebody who just recently announced that he is going to be vying for the presidency of these United States. He initially was going to run under the People Party banner, but now he is switching over and is going to be seeking the Green Party nomination. And so today we figured let's have a conversation both with Cornel West and Rosa Clemente and just build and find out where Dr. West is coming from. So with that being said, since Rosa, you hooked this all up, I'm going to step back, let you do the honors and kick things off.
Yeah, so we're so happy to have Dr. West on. We have marched with him, been with him, and you know, I was ecstatic when I heard it, and then I was like, wait a minute, the Greens? No, the party? Okay, and now the Green Party. So I was like, this is great. So Dr. West, when did you decide that you were going to run for president?
Well, first, let me just salute both of you all, just to be in conversation with you all, because I come to learn and listen. And when I get a chance to see you, Sister Rosa, and your magnificent witness over the years, you've been so consistent. I remember that moment we were in Ferguson. You said, let the young folks speak. Let the young folks speak. And they took over the microphone from the NAACP, your brother Cornel, and so forth. And you mediated with a love, but you were just there to let folk know that, look, this Black freedom struggle goes from one generation to the next. And then with Brother David D, you know, they just don't come better than that, brother. He represents the best of the East Bay and on so many different levels. And you see, for me, it's really the same calling. It's just running for truth and justice, condition of truth to allow suffering to speak. I come out of revolutionary Black Christian tradition that says the least of these, the lens through which you view the world. That's Martin, that's Fannie Lou, that's Ella Baker, that's Curtis Mayfield. That's actually also Count Basie. He come out of Calvary Baptist Church in Red Brooks, New Jersey, or Mount Zion Baptist Church that produced Sarah Vaughan. So that's my tradition. And so much of the campaign is a matter of saying, well, how do you run for truth and justice when you spill over into electoral politics? I hadn't planned to do that at all. I've said on a zillion occasions, you find me in the crack house before you find me in the White House. But the White House tied to war crimes, tied to corruption, organized greed, the whole host of things, crack house. Brothers and sisters trying to work it out, you know what I mean? And they can bounce back, but ain't the levels of corruption and war crimes there. But it turns out that at this particular moment in the history of the American empire, that we had to have, I thought, some voices, and Lift Every Voice is really the anthem of Black people, voices at the highest level to accent the ways in which the two-party system gets in the way of focusing on poor and working people. You all did that in 2008. With Sister Cynthia McKinney. Well, 2023, it becomes even more necessary to do that because it's just so very clear that you got the neo-fascist gangster on the one hand with Brother Trump, neoliberal hypocrite on the other hand with Brother Biden. They are not just turning their backs on poor and working people, but when it comes to poor and working people around the world, Biden's headed toward World War III. Trump's headed towards civil war here. Voices, people, people who are victimized by American militarism. I zero in on the West Bank. I zero in on Gaza. Doesn't make any difference which party is in the White House. They still got to deal with the bombs. They still got to deal with the attacks, Israeli defense forces and so forth. I would say the same thing about be they peasants in Brazil, peasants in Central America, and of course with the Ukraine, with those precious Ukrainian brothers and sisters having to pay a price, given the proxy war of an aggressive American empire mediated by NATO. NATO's an arm, an instrument of U.S. imperial power, and pushing Russia against the wall. And Putin's no friend of mine at all. He ain't no friend of mine whatsoever. But there's no doubt that the provocation was so intense that to have missiles right on the border, no empire would put up with it. And we know in the United States that there are Russian missiles or Chinese missiles in Mexico or Canada, they'd be blown to smithereens the same day. And there'd be parades all over the country. So we have to be consistent. We have to be morally, spiritually consistent. That's what I learned from Fannie Lou Hamer. That's what I learned from Ella Baker. That's what I learned from Brother Martin and Malcolm. And it's just a matter of the same calling, different context, no longer the classroom, no longer the streets, no longer the cells only. Now it spills over into presidential politics.
Did you wake up one day and you were like, talk to your family? Have you been in talks, obviously, with the People's Party, maybe the Green Party? But the moment, because I think that especially when we run for elected office, we also have to prepare for our families. And yeah, now that's even more than ever, right? Like the attack on our people is also, not only an attack on an individual, but a community, you know, and opening up yourself to the hate that's going to happen. I'm sure the death threats that will happen. When you talked and made that decision, what did that look like for you and the family?
Yeah, I mean, one, my wife, who loves me intensely, you know, she was actually against it because she always thought I would stay more in the prophetic lane rather than electoral political lane. And for me, the strongest argument against it had to do with the fact that it would have on my loved ones and family. There's no doubt about that. That was the strongest argument against it. And as I prayed on it and as I wrestled with it and had, talks with them and things, they were saying, well, you figure this is what you call to do, you got to go for it. But you're absolutely right, though, Sister Rose. You had the same kind of thing coming at you in 2008, though, right?
Oh, but thank God there was no social media. I wouldn't have been able to do it. You know, like, we got death threats, too. And our party inwardly kind of, some of them turned on us. But yeah, I didn't really see the impact on my family until now. I'm processing it because it'll be 15 years in July. But David, you know, I know you want to ask Dr. West, but I want to tell people too, it's David was there at at the Green Party nomination in Chicago. And like, I had been telling people and then everybody's like, you're crazy. That's funny. It's a joke. I'm like, no, I'm actually running. And when I get to Chicago, one of the first people I see is Davey.
Right.
He could I don't know why I didn't bring, I know why I didn't bring Justice and my daughter. We were broke. Like, I think we were even at my sister's house. But all that being said, it's such a toll. But I know so many people when you were like, I'm coming. A lot of people, you know, are ready to support you. And I think a lot of younger people, you know, so sorry, David, go ahead.
Oh, no. I think that's important that we kind of understand the family dynamics. But what I want to ask, and Rhoda, you can jump in on this as well after Dr. West answers. There are a few things that go on. You coming from the prophetic tradition, and what that implies as somebody who goes to church is that the prophetic tradition really means that you're rooted in a movement, right? And oftentimes when people run, the movement becomes the election and the campaign. And then afterwards, things disappear. So I saw this with Obama. I saw tons of people centered around that campaign. And then after he got elected, it disappeared. Now, some of us tried to kind of reignite that, and it was very difficult. Internally with the Democrats, they were pretty clear about we don't want to go any further than this, right? We're not trying to have no quote unquote movement. He had a bunch of people within his organization that had the potential to do that. I didn't really see it. And I know that when we were doing our work, we actually got sued, you know, to stop what we were trying to do. And so I bring this up because ideally people say, if you're running a campaign and it's one that might be against the odds, then the benefit is that you organize people and that you become a force. So my question to you is, have that been one in consideration? And two, do you have the infrastructure, the means, and all the things that are needed in the age of technology to make sure that whether you win, lose, or whatever, that there is now a force that needs to be reckoned with, that is organized, and that is more than just something that's centered around a campaign?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a wonderful question, though, brother. Definitely. We actually had that challenge with Brother Jesse in 1984 and 88. Where you had tremendous mobilization, the spirit, and so forth, but then it gets filtered and devoured into a corporate-dominated Democratic Party that uses its progressive as just a kind of window dressing. And this is one of the differences of third party versus working, trying to work within the corporate-dominated Democratic Party. That right now, I mean, one of the reasons why the shift to the Green Party, and I'm just still in the nominating process, of course, is that the Green Party, given all of its challenges and so forth, does have a much better infrastructure than the People's Party. People's Party had access to one state already. The Green Party has access to at least 17, 19. They can get another 20 or some in a matter of months. It may end up with 40. So how many states did you all have, though, Sister Rosa?
22. Maybe 23?
It was about 22, 23. And I think Nader had about 40-something.
Yeah. 22. Oh, yeah, mm-hmm.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then after the campaign, and part of it has to do with how people are educated, what I and others tell them when they come to the campaign. You see, my view is that the campaign is always just one moment in a larger movement effort. And it's not just domestic, but it's international. Mm. You see, that I'm a thoroughgoing internationalist. That's why I'm running to head the empire in order to dismantle the empire. I want to dismantle the imperial apparatus. I want to dismantle the ways in which military industrial complex always has a priority in our spending and so forth. So that the whole conception of the campaign is movement centered, which means the movements that are in place, the movements that can escalate after. Part of our problem, though, is that it's just so hard among leftists to be able to generate and sustain leftist movements regardless of campaigns at all. You have to have context in which you energize people and galvanize people, you see. And this has always been a challenge, it seems to me.
I know you mentioned that Jesse's movement in 84, definitely 88, got swallowed up into the Democratic Party. And we can talk about whether or not that was effective. But Rosa, since you're here with your insight, what did you see as a challenge to sustaining a movement? You all had, you know, a decent amount of votes, you know, coming in. What was it? Why didn't we see that momentum that you and Cynthia McKinney had kind of carry up and be built upon? Or was it built upon and we just didn't see it?
No, it wasn't built upon. I mean, again, the lack of social media, you know, that changed the game in electoral politics in general. You know, but so for people that don't know, because I think this is a lot of the confusion that we have to do better at building the narrative, right? Like the Green Party is not, and no other third party is not on a ballot in every state. And a lot of people don't understand you have to fight for ballot access. And the reason we have to still do that is because we've never gotten 5% of the entire votes. So when that election happens, We have to fight to get on the ballot. That itself, you know, if you don't have 50 states.
But you all were getting sued, right? Some of the states were trying to sue to stop.
Well, this is what I was going to say, too. Like, the Democrats are very good at fighting off our ballot access. So the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, especially, you saw this play out in Pennsylvania, where, you know, there was a Democratic Party was suing local people, including Sherry Pankala, who was the vice presidential candidate with Jill Stein before the last Jill Stein run with Ajamu Baraka. So I would say that that's the most important part. And, you know, until we get 5%, which I don't think is not attainable, it's just that we, all of us in this movement work, everything has been hijacked. Like, the narrative is just always attack, 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 destroy, destroy, destroy. And, you know, there's no way this isn't going to fall on Dr. West and his eventual and the other people, excuse me, because Dr. West will be running in a primary because there'll be other candidates. I'm sure that the Green Party will want to run, or maybe not, you know, but I think the main thing we have to really instill is that as movement people, the ballot is a tool. It's not the whole arsenal, you know?
Right.
And I personally, like, I don't believe there is a good electoral political project anymore. I think that's all dead, you know? And I also believe that's with the failing of institutions and no trust in institutions, that's gonna hit the movement too. You know, like, we're not, we have issues in all of that, but the trust, that's what I feel young people, they don't trust anything. They don't trust an institution. They don't trust movement folks. They don't trust somebody like Dr. West in a campaign, because everything that they've seen is an attack. And plus, they're also, for the last 8 years, this generation has been filled with Trump, whether they watch TV or not. And I think that's a big mistake. So what, and Dr. West, I want to, you know, you to address this. So when you want Democracy Now, you said, you know, Sister Amy, I'm going after Trump voters. As a strategy, I don't think that's where you should go. You know, I mean, and I personally don't have any, I mean, maybe this is why I won't ever run again. I don't even want to think about them in that way. I want to use that time to build an internal movement that will support a Green Party. But the Green Party also has to have its own reckoning, and hopefully that will happen. With that being said, when you said you were running, I was like, dope. And then I have my issues with the People's Party after reading things that the man has been accused of. But, you know, I think this is a perfect opportunity. I think the young people are primed. And, you know, I believe they want someone they can believe in, but they also have a different way of doing things. So with that being said, why is that your strategy, that you're like, of course, we're going to get to people on the left, Black, Latino, all of that. But when you said, I want to go after the Trump voters, can you really? I mean, isn't this like a cult at this time?
I hear what you're saying. I hear, and you're full of so many insights, my dear sister. I deeply appreciate you. But one, we got to keep in mind that one out of nine folk who voted for Trump voted for Bernie. And I was with Bernie twice. You know, his critique of Wall Street was strong. His critique of American imperialism, not strong enough. His refusal to support reparations for me was completely unpersuasive and unconvincing. I've been part of the reparations movement for the last 55 years. So there's a number of things I agreed and disagreed with. But if one out of nine voted for Trump, it means that they are still working people who are wounded and marginalized, but they're following a neo-fascist Pied Piper than having people available to them to give them a different vision and venue through which they can express their frustrations. Of course, you got a whole host of xenophobes, folk who hate Black folk, brown folk, indigenous peoples, immigrants, gays, lesbians, trans, non-binary, and so forth. But at the same time, you also have a heterogeneous group of folk, some of whom just hate the arrogance and the condescension of the neoliberal Democratic Party. They will never, ever, ever vote for them. So the only alternative when Bernie's not available was Trump. Yeah. So that if, but keep in mind, my dear sister, that's not my priority. You know, when I said I'm going to Trump country, I didn't say that's where I'm starting. I'm going to launch in Mississippi. We launch in with the Emmett Till family in Mississippi in August. And we're going to be dealing with the situation of our brother Jenkins and Parker, Michael Jenkins and, you know, and Eddie Parker. Y'all probably heard about this situation. Police brutalized them and so forth. And that's a catalyst because it's also the 68th anniversary of the vicious murder of brother Emmett himself. And right. So we're going to start in Mississippi, and that is going to be a good time and a serious time. Because like my brother say, all roads to Black America in some way lead through Mississippi.
Right.
My pastor, the brother who baptized me, Reverend Willie P. Cook, Shiloh Baptist Church, Mississippi to the core. And I'll never be half the man he was. And he never went to college, but at least two colleges went through him. So that when I talk about going to Trump country, that's not the primary strategy. Right. That's going to be one, you know, secondary, tertiary, but part of the overall attempt to bear witness to the Black freedom tradition and struggle.
Dr. West, look at people right now in the eye who spent the last 4 years campaigning to stop the onslaught of fascism. They put Biden in office. They did what needed to be done. Many of these people who Rosa Clemente has alluded to, they were the ones that were doing parties, you know, in battleground states. I know I DJed like 14 or 15 alone, right? Mm-hmm. And people, and they organized and they did everything that needed to be done. They came out, registered, phone bank, did the whole nine. And they put somebody in the White House. Now, tell me, tell them why they should vote for you after they invested so much time to try and, you know, put somebody into the White House. Is it very clear that that person, Biden, Harris, is not going to follow through on things that are needed? Or, you know, the threat of a Trump, is it, does it outweigh the neoliberalism of a Biden and Harris? Why should they get behind you? Because that's going to be a primary audience for you.
No, it's true. And I was part of that crowd. You see that I said we have to have, in the end, after a whole lot of cognac and other things, we're going to have to hold our breath and our noses and vote in an anti-fascist manner against Trump. Biden gets in there. Who put him in there? Black people, especially Black sisters, 96%. 18% of Black mothers voted for the gangster. We got to keep that in mind, voted for Trump. But generally speaking, Black folk put him in there. When it comes to voting rights for Black people, John Lewis bill, couldn't make a deal with Manchin, couldn't eliminate filibuster. But when it comes to the debt ceiling agreement, he can make a deal with Manchin. The pipeline still goes through, devastating working class communities and adding to ecological collapse. Meaning that the very people who put Biden in still was afterthoughts and tertiary. Hmm. You see? Now, when it comes to World War III with the Ukraine, we're headed toward nuclear exchange, it's been the Biden administration. The militarism intense, $120 billion put in that war so far. But he can't come up with no money when it comes to dealing with poverty. Can't come up with hardly anything to end mass incarceration. Can't come up with anything in terms of seriously supporting workers. He shut down the railroad strike. Let us know what side he's on. So that I can understand people who did opt in that way. But when it comes to poor folk in Mississippi, Biden can't come through. In fact, it's been the opposite. He cut back on poor people in the debt ceiling agreement, and yet allowed for military expansionism to go on, leading toward possible World War III. So the choice almost between, with Trump, you got a gangster, white supremacist tied to big military tied to big money. That's what fascism is. The rule of big money and military with a Pied Piper that's convincing the people to scapegoat the most vulnerable rather than confront the most powerful could lead towards civil war. With Biden, you got possible World War III. Not just with the Russians, with China too.
So somebody would say, Dr. Cornel West, we got to compromise in politics. You give a little, you take a little. Right. And what we're seeing is, you know, we just got to, you know, Biden has to play the game. It's chestnut checkers. Remember, they said that under Obama.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So what's your response to people who would say something like that?
Well, one is, though, I mean, premature compromise is really a form of cowardly opportunism. I don't mind being improvisational. I'm a jazz man. And improvisation is built into how we move. We flexible, we fluid, no doubt about that. But you don't punt on the second down. If you have to punt the last minute, then you make that decision the last minute. You don't do it at the beginning of the scrimmage, first down, second down. You make decisions in real time, you see, absolutely. So there's always an improvisation. I don't believe in dogmatism just being static all the time. But I do believe that we have to be free enough to speak the truth as it relates to the suffering of poor and working people and the suffering of Black people, the suffering of Latinos, the suffering of Indigenous peoples, the suffering of the immigrants, and the suffering of those friends who no one called the wretched of the earth around the world. So the U.S. empire is doing damage every day. And are we to turn our backs to that? See what I mean? I mean, it's I give you an example of what I'm talking about. You see that, look at what happened January 7th, 2014 in the West, on the West Bank. 551 Palestinian babies were killed in 50 days. And not one U.S. politician could raise their voices because he's so accommodating to, compromising to, the Democratic Party stands on the Middle East and Israel. And to me, that is a form of spiritual obscenity. And yet the same politicians want to say they're so concerned about a certain death that happens in America and can't say a mumbling word about the U.S. support of $4 billion. To the Israeli Defense Forces that could kill 551 babies in 50 days, kill over 2,000. See, that kind of self-containment is a form of cowardliness. The Black Freedom Movement dies if all we have is just cowardly compromises. There's no movement. And that doesn't mean we don't have to get practical and improvisation at a particular moment. But if we're not telling the truth across the board, the same is truth in terms of mass incarceration, same is truth in terms of the workers' movements, the same is truth in terms of trade union movements and so forth. Then how do we proceed if we can't be free in telling those truths and pursuing that justice, you say? Does that make sense, Sister Rosa?
Yeah, I mean, that's why everything around critical race, banning books, all that's happening. Like, I do think that people need to know the long history, right? Like, this has happened before. Books have been banned. You know, there were systems in New York City where if you were bilingual, you were penalized, even corporate punishment if you spoke Spanish, right? The fact that in Puerto Rico, they didn't even talk about slavery until 2000, the history books that came out in 2000, you know? So all this knowledge, you know, and I understand people's reactions to what is happening, but if you have a long historical view, you know that the new part about this is the way it gets out there. Everything is fast, everything is furious, everything's frenetic. But something you said about Trump, which I talk to my husband all the time about this, some of the things he's saying, he's right. Now, why he's saying them, I don't know. Like, that's craziness. So, well, some of the things he's saying, right? And I think that has actually moved some African-Americans and a growing number of Latino, Latina, Latinx folks into the Republican Party. And so if we look at all the new congresswomen or state officials, Latina women that won office in the last big election, all of them are Republican. They're visually Mexicano, maybe even Afro-Mexicano. They got the Trump flag and all of that. And that's why Trump had to go to that Cuban restaurant to solidify not just the Cuban vote, but the Venezuelan vote, because what could happen in Florida, and I think, you know, Florida is going to be big for you in this sense. The demographic of people who can vote has changed with the influx of Puerto Ricans. Mm-hmm. Nobody's speaking to Puerto Ricans, right? Yes, yes. They're from the Caribbean. You know, Miami and the Florida is very interesting around like Caribbean folks and all of that. So, but, you know, I think after the last election, I was telling probably Davey and a couple other people, I said, you know, Biden could have swung that state even harder if he had gone and spoke to the Boricuas that have been forced since Hurricane Maria. The Orlando population is increasingly becoming majority Puerto Rican, but most of those that have left the island post the hurricane, instead of going to old cities like Chicago, Illinois, I mean, Chicago, New York City, they're in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that can also bring people out. And you got the young brother there who's queer and Latino who won. And nobody even saw his race happening. So I could see some of the, you know, interventions that we do.
Absolutely. And that's very much what I had in mind in terms of trying to understand what goes through the minds, hearts, and souls of folk who find themselves drifting in that direction.
But yeah, and it's scary. It's scary. The amount of Latino men that they've polled who are more willing now to vote for Trump, but also people don't, I don't think people know that the Proud Boys, the leader is a Latino. There's a lot of Latino men for some reason in the Proud Boys, oh, whatever, all of that, which as a Latina, I'm afraid, but also as a Puerto Rican, I'm like, they're just white supremacists with brown skin. Like, we got to cut, like, moving, like, Latinos are not the only reason why white supremacy exists. But with that, I think young people are looking for someone to be unapologetic in their politic and also not shame if they don't fully believe in this process.
Yes, absolutely.
I think before you answer that, I want to add to what you were saying, Rosa. What you described is disturbing, but we shouldn't overlook the fact that there is a nativist movement just in the country in general. You see a lot of brothers and sisters have bought into that as well. You've been talking a lot about foreign policy, and there's a lot of people, you know, and I know you've spoken with some of them in the ADOS and the FBA movements that are like, I don't care about these people over there, there, and there. What about us right here, Black Americans, right? And, you know, in a very macabre way, that point of view has been amplified in Trump country. How do you thread the needle with that sort of mindset? You know, nativism versus intersectionality, nativism and a conservatism versus, you know, folks who are like, hey, we're all here, trans, non-binary. There's a backlash, you know, in all these communities, ours included, around these concepts. And so it can easily result in folks going to the other side. You know, there are people that I know that secretly cheer. Like, if they're shutting down all these trans right things, have at it. You know, I mean, I have to erase more than a few comments on my Facebook thread, you know, just so that they don't see the light of day because people feel that way. So you being coming from this prophetic tradition and having the politics that you've had over, you know, the three decades I've known you, how do you make that appeal when people are really feeling, for whatever reason, right or wrong, that they have been left out of the conversation, of the mix, that they're not being addressed, and that they'll go to, you know, wherever, even if it's the devil themselves, to get some sort of recognition?
No, that's very real. I mean, you know, I mean, the history of the Black church, we've had to come to terms with patriarchy and homophobia and transphobia. That's been as concrete in terms of the people who are there getting degraded and demeaned. And you have to stay in that context and let folk know that you are siding with the least of these, you're siding with the most vulnerable. So when I talked about going to Trump country, part of that means I'm going to Black and brown slices of it too.
Yes, you're right.
They got deep anti-immigrant. One reason I went to the ADOS conference, I have deep love for my dear sister Yvette and brother Antonio, and I was telling them, ain't nothing wrong with being for reparations. I've been for reparations for the last 45 years, but I can be for reparations without any attempt to become anti-immigrant and put down brothers and sisters in the Caribbean, right? Malcolm, Caribbean, Stokely Carmichael, Caribbean. We can go on and on and on, Caribbean. June Jordan, Caribbean, some of our greatest freedom fighters have come from the Caribbean.
Harry
and
Belafonte. We got
Harry Belafonte. We ain't got the Albizu Campos yet or Julio de Burgos yet. You know what I mean? Say, hey, wait a minute. Do you realize what you're saying when you're talking about? And they'll say, no, they're different. Well, what makes them different? Well, they like Sister Rosa. They freedom fighters who embrace the oppressed people's struggles and still are rooted in their own distinctive histories. That's why we like Kwame Ture Stokely Carmichael. We know he from Trinidad. He never denied Trinidad, but he's embracing Mama Mae Johnson in Alabama in a way that many Black folks from the States are not embracing. So that you accent the examples that have brought people together, but it means you still have to speak to their needs though. Because there are some deep tensions with immigrants coming in to be used as cheap labor to keep wages down and the ruling classes and the economic elites exploiting them and pitting them against U.S. workers who've been in the United States for a long time. And you have to be able to speak to that honestly and try to come up with ways in which workers can come together with a deeper solidarity. That's part of the honesty. And I tell you this though, really, I mean, At the center of this campaign, to tell you the truth, is Black music. Hmm. Black music is the greatest artistic breakthrough of the most barbaric 20th century. And what is it about? It's about three things. First, you got to be honest about catastrophe. That's the blues. Catastrophe lyrically expressed, catastrophically honestly confronted, catastrophe artistically transfigured. That's the history of Black people. The only way to preserve our sanity and dignity is honest about catastrophe. It ain't about problems. Strange Fruit ain't about no problem. It's catastrophes visited on Black folk. It ain't no race problem. It becomes a race problem in the classroom, but it's a catastrophe when it's lived out. So how does that relate to politics? Well, it means you got to be honest. You can't deodorize the discourse. You got to keep it funky. Be as honest and candid as you can about the catastrophes being visited on women, on Black folk, on indigenous peoples, on workers. But then the other element is swing. And what is swing in Black music? It's to authorize a conception of time that always keeps open a different and better future, so we never find ourselves running up into a dead end, no matter how overwhelming the situation is. It's got to have swing. That's what Duke was talking about. Don't mean a thing if it ain't got no swing, because people find themselves completely circumscribed and contained. And then improvisation. You got to be wise enough to time your judgments enough to know when to move, when to be able to proceed in a certain kind of direction. We see that's Black music right there. And Black music has been, globally speaking, the most powerful force for good in terms of confronting catastrophe, in terms of authorizing different conceptions of time and rhythm and syncopation and funk and improvisational. That's precisely why the recording industry and the oligarchs have tried to dumb it down, because they know if they can, in a substantive way, squeeze out that Black musical tradition, then all you're gonna do is end up with opportunists, premature compromisers in leadership, be they a politician, be they in economics, or any other kind of leadership, you see. And so in that sense, I think that you can't really contain the spirit of Black musical tradition. And that's why they're not gonna be able to contain, in a certain sense, at least the impact of the campaign. The impact of the campaign is not just practical, it is spiritual, immeasurable, invisible, and touching the hearts and minds and souls, especially of young folk, to let them know somebody loves them, somebody's concerned about them, somebody's trying to find a way out and embrace them. And once they raise their voices, shoot, they got visions and analysis I know not of.
Right.
I'm 70 years old. I'm still tied to Curtis Mayfield. They're doing all kind of new stuff now. I got to learn and listen from them.
Before I toss it back to Rosa Clemente, when you add up the improvisation, the catastrophe, the honesty, the earnesty, and the swing, Rosa alluded to this earlier, it brings hope. And that's what's been missing. I think hope and imagination have been two things that have been stamped out. And how do you really, I know you know, what are some policies that you might champion? What are some things you envision down the road to really kind of get that jump started? And when you talked about Black music had always been this thing that reminded us that we can make a way out of no way. That's the essence of all our music, all the way up to hip hop. So, you know, policy wise, how do you see yourself infusing that? I don't know if there is a policy, but, you know,
but you think it is, though. But it's only by example. Y'all heard what Andre 3000 said just today. He said the hip hop is just too money driven. And we've been talking about commodification ever since the genius of Greg Tate and Bell Hooks and the other. That goes all the way back. But he just said, now I want to see imagination, what both of y'all talking about. I want to see more vision. Now you got J. Cole and you got Rhapsody and Lupe and them still around. It's not like you don't have any at all. But the dominant orientation is one of just money, status, spectacle, bling, bling, and so forth. Well, what do you do? Only by example. Young folk want to see people in motion, willing to speak the truth and sacrifice for something bigger than their egos tied to their own young people's experience. And that's what I think about my own life. You see, when I saw Martin and Malcolm, when I saw Huey and Erica Huggins, when I saw Angela Davis, I was a teenager, right? I'm trying to steal away from slow dancing with the purple lights in the garage, trying to do all kind of other things. And I'm influenced by their example. I said, yes, I want to be like that. And then you make a calling, and here it is 50 years later, still trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, now us celebrating or, you know, commemorating the 50 years of hip hop, you know what, I feel like there hasn't been a Me Too reckoning in hip hop culture. You know, it's slowly happening. But it's a rough time, like, you know, to be born in the Bronx at that year and have my personal connection and then my activism around hip hop, it makes me sad. You know, you mentioned J. Cole, Lupe Fiasco, you know, Jean Grey, Rhapsody, Mumu Fresh. We could go down the line, especially with women, but it's been marred by this inability for the men. These are not young people. These are grown men who still have very bad behavior, who are predators that are being awarded every day, you know, within all the hip hop stuff that's going on. And until hip hop can have that, until hip hop can become again the voice of the people, what you're saying around music is very true, and especially how it is about artists. But it's also about, you know, again, dealing with the patriarchy and misogyny in the culture still, you know, and why so many of us had to kind of pivot away from that. I mean, when I got the nomination, my whole speech was the hip hop political agenda that we created. And if we look at the bigger picture, we know that why Raz Barak is in office with the support of hip hop and his who he represents. You know, we know why Chokwe Antar is in Jackson, Mississippi as the mayor. You see these kind of things, but then I see some of their policies and I'm like, see, that's the compromise. I'm not good at that. You know, I would be like, I have no, you know, but an elected official often has to make those decisions. But I wanted to ask you, Dr. West, Roe versus Wade, the overturning, the attacks on trans, queer, LGBTQIA people. I'm seeing more an attack on poor people that I've never seen before. You know, when that happened, what was your reaction? did you think it was going to happen? I thought it might. We talked about it for years that it might, but when it happened, and what did you feel about particularly the women in your life, you know, your nieces or Dart or any of the young women that you know, like when you heard that?
Well,
what was your reaction?
No, I was under the impression that it was certainly happening. You might remember with my dear brother Carl Dix and Sister Susara Taylor, who had already had a massive rallies around the country. And this is the Revolutionary Communist Party. You know, I've been working with them, as you know, for many years. I don't agree with everything, but I love those brothers and sisters when it comes to fighting for poor people. And one of the issues that they made a priority was trying to protect reproductive rights for women. Now, people thought somehow that that was a bad decision. It turned out to be a very good one because that they were hitting that issue head on. I was blessed to be with them in that regard. But I think it is inseparable from, as you were saying before, you know, the attack on Black people and workers and others. But the question, see, in the end, though, has to do with this issue of trying to be consistent. So when you talk about the misogyny, you talk about the patriarchy and the various ways of losing sight of humanity, of precious trans and non-binary, that your voice just has to be like a drumbeat, constant. And then you try to conform your behavior. Now, we're always going to have folk falling short. I mean, that's been the beginning all the way back to you know, the 17th century, you know what I mean? The brothers, we always got a challenge. We don't need no excuses for us messing up, but we always got a challenge, you know. The sisters going to have their own challenges in terms of their humanity and their faults and foibles. And so, but we have to just cast a spotlight on patriarchy, misogyny, any kind of losing sight of humanity of folk, and say, now it's just wrong, but you have to be accountable. You got to take responsibility. Certainly not to be rewarded. Certainly not to be overlooked and hidden and so forth and so on. But at the same time, we also got to be able to tease out the best of all of us. I mean, that's really, in the end, I think what it is.
I know
it's getting late. I got a little 1 o'clock thing, but I'm going to go over with y'all as long as I can.
Yeah.
Oh,
we got to have another one.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, we're going to have more than one. We're going to have more than one. Absolutely.
We're going to talk. I'm not running for vice president. People have been asking me, no. I know who I want Dr. West to pick. I'll say that another time. But all you young folks watching right now, please go to Dr. West's and the campaign page. Become a member of the Green Party, $20, and you're a member. You have to go and switch if you're a Democrat or Republican. But for all those that are watching, please make sure you start following the campaign. And for those who want to be a member of the Green Party, just go to their website. Yes, so I know you have to run. David, go ahead.
I have one last question, and briefly, and we'll have you come back, Dr. West. Three policies that you would want to put in specifically. What is a policy like Dr. West is president? What's the policy that you want to run on? Two or three that we can really wrap our teeth around?
One would be I'm an abolitionist when it comes to poverty. I'm an abolitionist when it comes to housing. I've said over and over again, I'm not going to move into the White House until everybody has a house. That's the spirit of what it means to be a servant of the people. Every leader who's a genuine leader is willing to put the people at the center. Now, so it's abolitionist. I'm building on Angela Davis, building on Sister Ruth Gilmore, was all of that great abolitionist thing. Same would be true in terms of mass incarceration. I want to end mass incarceration, come up with new ways in which you can have rehabilitation centers and ways in which education, ways in which resources can be invested to make sure all the creativity and imagination and intelligence of the brothers and sisters who have been incarcerated can be unleashed in the world. That's one. I'm Medicare for all, falling back on Brother Bernie. That's still very real. That's still very, very real. Now, I'm also with it in terms of the free education, not just tuition, but education across the board.
Absolutely.
Because I believe from Canada and other places, we learned that access to education makes a difference in terms of reinforcing the possibilities that poverty rates do not increase. And the two go hand in hand. But the third one is the cutback of militarism and the dismantling of the imperial apparatus, beginning with Pentagon, State Department, Homeland Security. We don't need 800 military units around the world. We don't need troops in 150 countries. You only do that when you act as if you are the policeman of the world. When you militarize the world, it comes back and militarizes your own society with the militarism of the police, militarism of educational institutions, militarism of our communities, and you end up with a whole militarized world. Everybody concerned about guns and who's going to get shot. So those would be three basic ones, and it's not new. It comes right out of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy. What we got to deal with? Poverty, militarism, materialism, and white supremacy and other forms of xenophobia.
That's why this right wing is weaponizing everything that speaks to our resistance. They're attacking the people we support who are visible leaders. They're threatening, they're showing up at people's homes, they're going into the school board, much like the Heritage Foundation did in the early 80s when they took over the school boards. They're doing that, but the violence, verbal and physical, is probably something new in the sense of these folks really feeling like empowered to do whatever they want to you because there's going to be no consequences for the most part or accountability. It makes sense then why they want to ban anything and why they're going specifically to middle schools, because they're trying to capture the hearts and minds of all these kids, right? And that the white younger white people are pretty aware of what is happening. And a lot of them have turned on their own parents, you know, and joined or become allies. But the whole, this is exactly what they're doing. And, you know, I think it's so important that we always be and help voters to be educated, because the scariest person to me is the one that goes in the booth without voter education and gets swept up in all the circus show that is happening right now, where, like you said, the material conditions of our people have not changed. They have gotten worse.
No, that's real. But we should always remember, beginning with John Coltrane's Love Supreme, that Black love in a white supremacist world is a crime.
That's the real price talk.
The price of loving Black people at the deepest level is the willingness to live and die for Black people, even when they hate you. You don't love Black people for them to love you back. You love Black people because they're worthy of being loved. That's true for Puerto Rican. That's true for Latino. That's true for Indigenous people. That's true for poor peoples across the board. So that ain't new for us. They just trying to keep fear in us. They want us to be intimidated and run around scared. Well, you know what? What breaks the back of any fear? Love and light. That's the history of Black folk at our highest, you see. Love and light, so we can get some light in the tunnel and some love that keeps us swinging. Because back to swinging in the face of the catastrophe, but with style and a smile. Because we got to find joy in this now. We got to find some joy. Oh, if we don't find no joy, then we're not true to the Black musical tradition.
Yeah, and people need to see that. You know, people need to see us resisting with joy. You know, you can't go to young people and be all solemn and despondent and everything, and it's all bad and we're all gonna die. Yes, we all are. That's just the way of the world. But to hone into that is so critical. So I think you might have to go, Dr. West. I'm gonna let Davey.
Dr. West, we appreciate
you. Love y'all. Love you. I know we're running late, but you know I could talk to y'all all day.
We're gonna do this more.
We're gonna do this regularly because you all uplift me. You uplift me in so many ways.
Hard Knocks Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.